Hello and welcome back to Politics and Polls. I'm Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University. One of the things that we often don't think about when we follow what's going on overseas, particularly in zones of conflict, are the people who actually take the pictures of what's happening, who take the photographs that allow us to see on the ground what it means when a war, when military conflict is unfolding. And when we think back at some of the iconic conflicts that we as a nation have lived through here, World War II, Vietnam, Operation Desert Storm, Afghanistan, Iraq, we think of the photographs. That constitutes our memory. And often in our discussions, we talk about the reporters who write the stories, but the photographers, in many ways, are the front lines of what we see and what we remember when talking about war. And so today, we're very fortunate to have with us Jonathan Alperi, who is the author of a fascinating and gripping new book called The Shattered Lens, A War Photographer's True Story of Captivity and Survival in Syria, which has come out with Simon & Schuster, that recounts his harrowing days in captivity in Syria, as well as his career before and his career and life after captivity. Jonathan's been a photographer in multiple theaters of war and has taken photographs for many different publications, the Paris Match, Time, Newsweek, the Boston Globe. He's been in East Africa, the Middle East, Central Asia, and elsewhere. And he went to school in New York City, and he studied medieval history at the University of Chicago. So, Jonathan, welcome to our show.
Thank you for having me.
So let me begin. Maybe you can just recount to our listeners what the story in the book is about, where you were in captivity and what happened.
The central core of the book is about, obviously, what had happened to me in Syria after covering the conflict for the third time. And what had transpired into after covering this battle for 10 days and then being captured actually the last day of my trip before returning to Lebanon. So the central portion of the book is about that, obviously, but then it goes further into other conflict zones that I've covered and my thoughts about the relationship between Islam and the West and specifically with Europe.
When did you become a photographer professionally?
I became a photographer in college. I remember my senior year in high school, I already knew I wanted to do that. And my first introduction to photography was a little bit earlier. It was probably 1996 when I would travel around Europe to take pictures of ancient Roman sites. That was the real catalyst for me to plunge myself into a career like this where I would be able to connect history and a career. So therefore, photography was the medium to allow me to immerse myself in history. And before that, I wanted to be a soldier, but you know, I'm not so good at taking orders, so I don't think that would work out so well. And I started shooting for local newspapers in Chicago, and I was an assistant to a well-known Chicago photographer. That's how I all started.
And then how did you decide to become war photographer? I don't know the term that you like to use, but when did you decide that was the subject matter that you wanted to capture?
No, war photography is good. It's always been there. Since I was a kid, I was always fascinated by war from a very literal point. I was reading constantly, and I was building dioramas, and I was building model airplanes, and I was always immersing myself in this kinds of activities, played a lot of board games, and I still do actually, and with my best friend in Paris. And so I knew very quickly that if I had, like I said before, photography was just the medium that allowed me to experience war and be in it. But the core of who I am in that sense is wanted to be in conflict.
And did you have military family who had served?
I have many, actually. I have great grandparents who fought in World War One. I have.
And this is in France.
Yes,
I'm sorry. Before you moved, yeah.
Yeah, in the French army. One specifically fought in Verdun in 1916 and was gassed there and survived. I have grandparents who fought in World War II in the French army. I have one who's a partisan. I have uncles who fought also in World War II and Dien Bien Phu, Indochina, as well as Algeria. So there was a whole, everybody really was involved in significantly in conflict.
And so part of your interest was to show the images of kind of experiences they had been through, obviously, in the modern experience. How important is it for people to see what war is as opposed to simply hearing or reading about it? How does it change to see the images in your mind?
We're a very visual civilization, especially in the United States, more than ever and more than any other countries in the Western world. And therefore, photography like films are very important in developing people's ideas to what things might have been or what they are now, what they can be in the future. And reading about wars can always bring a romantic side of things, which was the case for me as a younger person. But photography is very gritty. It's very to the point. It's very clear. And what you see is kind of what you get. So if you take pictures of casualties or combat, and people who are back home and they see it, you really get to more of a visual understanding to what things can be. And that's how close maybe you can get to understanding unless you go there yourself.
And when you were captured, did they know you were a photographer or was it more random than that?
No, they knew I had all this equipment and, you know, they went through my computer. So they knew this was what I was doing. And they had organized this capturing probably a few days before, and I was still operating, and they know there was this international foreign photographer shooting in the area, so they knew what I was up to.
And is the idea to have someone for ransom or for geopolitical purposes? Is that why they capture you?
I don't believe it was personal. You know, it certainly didn't really take it this way. It's obviously to provide a significant war effort, to get money to be able to buy, of course, ammunition and have some political leverage over other groups because you have more money than the others. So in war, things, rules don't apply, or there are different sets of rules that are followed. And capturing innocent people who are actually covering their side is not something they would think twice about.
Do you get, when you're a photographer, are you covered under any kind of international law or protections, or are you on your own?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Well, I have multiple passports, but as an American citizen, I know that this was told to me by the FBI, obviously, is that when a U.S. citizen is captured and tortured in a foreign land, so it's considered a terrorist act, this legal, the DOJ opens a case, and mine is still open, which means that whoever captured or tortured you should be open. Always be captured by U.S. law and brought to American justice and judged. That's the kind of power American law has. So you have that protection. Obviously, when you're on the ground, that means nothing, because are you going to go out and get these guys and bring them to court in New York? No, that doesn't happen. But it's just a legal framework that this country is very fond upon.
And then there's a way to read your account of your own captivity, which is it's pretty phenomenal in that there's characters in the book and you're reading about each individual who's captured you, and you almost forget at a moment that you're the captive recounting all these people who surrounded you, your interaction with them, even moments of levity in the book. Did you intend to write it that way, to humanize them? And when you were captive, were you observing all the time? How did you possibly remember or capture the essence of all these different individuals?
Yeah, it was very much the purpose to humanize things a bit, because what happens is, even though they've done torturing you, they were torturing you and they're, you know, holding you hostage and you're going through all these problems, like everything in war, as the military situation in the area was getting more and more dire, you do end up suffering with these guys, and if you don't eat, they don't eat either. If you get bombed, you get bombed together. If they're stressed, everybody's stressed together. So there's a bond that gets created. Because I was living with these guys. It's not like I was in a cell in prison like other kidnappers. I was living in the house with these guys. Of course, the first month, I was blindfolded and handcuffed, and I didn't see any much, and I was being beat up. But then when things got better, you become kind of like part of the decor, and partially because I spent a lot of time trying to for them to like me.
One of the quotes in your book that I found fascinating is you wrote, "Eating the hummus and the cheese and the lamb with the others was the closest thing I had to any sense of community, and that was tenuous at best. But for their part, they seemed to accept the presence of the foreigner, this infidel. At times I suspected they'd gotten so used to me that they were reluctant to let me go, like some kind of a mascot." And then you write, "Their lives would have lost that tinge of cosmopolitanism had they not been able to say, 'Hey, John,' a few times a day." What did you mean by that?
It is true that after some time, even some guys I remember were not particularly happy to have me around, in a sense that even two guys specifically who spoke a little bit of English and the other ones, some French, said it made the Syrian people look bad to the international community because, you know, they're doing things to guys like us. And we were kind of on their side, meaning we were covering their side. It didn't mean that politically I agreed with the rebellion. That's another conversation, but that we can have, of course. And for them to see you like this every day, and I would do things, for example, before some of them would dress up to battle, I would stand up and I would like help them to dress up and tell them this is better to put it this way. One had a baseball cap and you want to look kind of cool. And I was so... these were always meant for me to insert myself in their community and be like them. And obviously for them, hopefully, to forget about me a little bit so I could do my own stuff as well.
Well, I'll follow up on that. How did your understanding of the Civil War, of the rebellion, change through this experience?
Well,
if at all.
Yeah, no, it didn't change anything. My second trip in Syria, which was where I saw the most combat, it was by far the most dangerous trip ever, probably one of the most dangerous trips I've ever taken. And you could tell that already, and I was on assignment for CNN, and they interviewed me actually on top of the photo essay that was published, of what I thought about these rebels, because it was very early in the war. It was the war was barely a year old. And they were already talking about Islamists and bin Laden. They were already mentioning elements that were allowing me to think that the rebellion was either going to be changed into a much more radical version of from its beginning. And that's exactly what happened. And for various reasons, from external reasons and internal reasons as well.
Well, let me follow up again, and it gets a bit away from your book, but you have been there. You have seen Syria in a way very few of us have. What's going on from the perspective that you had? What is taking place in that civil war that makes it so brutal and vicious? What's driving it?
So I think to answer your question, it's important to rephrase a certain word. Mm-hmm. In my opinion, and it's never been a civil war. Syria is a much more of a proxy conflict, almost a regional war where you have external powerhouses like Russia and the United States, and to a lesser extent, Europe, Saudi Arabia, and Iran, and then lesser ones, and Israel also, but to a more discrete level, but have a stake in this conflict. And from the Russian perspective, and it's important to speak about Russia before, because the Western media has been kind of just telling us one side of the story. People, we should go back to 1999 when we allowed Kosovo to detach itself from Serbia. From the Serbian perspective, this was treason because historically its geographical core is Kosovo. things changed over time a bit with the Ottomans. But at the end, Putin never forgave us for that because they have a strong relationship with Serbia. The second strike was Libya. As much as we kind of hated Gaddafi, it's still someone we can negotiate with, and we agreed to let his nuclear program go. And instead, we still got rid of him, and we killed him. And that led to something maybe we should talk about at a later point of this interview, is the migrant problem in Europe, and Islam, therefore. And Syria was probably the Russians' equivalent of their own red line, saying NATO is going too far. You have Ukraine, and then the Baltic states became NATO members. Then Georgia wants to be a NATO member. For Russia, it's seen as being surrounded from their perspective, that NATO's borders are getting closer and closer from buffer zones that came out of 1945, which was the Warsaw Pact in Poland and Eastern Europe. And from the Russian side, it's really seen as a threat. And obviously, Bashar al-Assad was a very strong ally to each other, with Iran obviously in the mix. And Putin was not going to let that go. And then obviously, you know, if you have to choose between the lesser, you know, the lesser of two evils, you know, probably Gaddafi would have been better to stay in power, considering what's happening now in that country, which pretty much doesn't exist anymore.
Now, to connect it to the book, your captors, did they talk about these kinds of issues? Meaning, for an average rebel who does something as horrendous as this, how much are they talking about the geopolitical aspects of what they're doing, and how much is much more mundane or not as thought out?
No, it's a very good question. It's interesting because when you talk to these guys, and even in previous trips working in the Middle East, the country that's always seen as the issue in meddling in people's affairs and nations' affairs is Israel. Israel is always mentioned as the country who's always behind the scene pulling the strings. We can have a conversation about that. Israel has its interests, and you know, everybody has interests, and they work behind the scenes, so that's nothing unusual. But they really see Israel as a nation who's very much attached intellectually to what people would say, what conspiracy theories are. And obviously, each one of us has to be very careful, and you have to study very carefully what the situations actually are before you can talk. But I remember the things they were saying about Israel, but also about Europe and France, because you know, I'm French. And they're always asking me, are the French going to intervene? Are they going to help us? You know, thinking that France was on their side, but deep inside I knew that France was not going to do anything because we don't have anything to do. We don't have, you know, not much left in terms of an army. And furthermore, it felt like they were being a little naive, hoping that because they were fighting the good fight, well, in reality, it's much more grayer. There are a lot of different shades of gray who make the situation super complicated.
And then the process of your release, how were you ultimately freed, and who was behind that?
I was freed, and I was incredibly lucky. The way it transpired is this, I can't say his name for safety reason, but he's a powerful and very wealthy businessman / parliamentary man in Syria, so a Syrian national, who has, like a lot of people in that part of the world, have their hands in everything, on sticky fingers, and he did have contacts with rebels. And he was looking to make a good name for himself because the European Union and the United States had created a blacklist of influential Syrian people who were close to the regime, and by doing so, they would be allowed legally to freeze all their assets. A lot of these people have businesses abroad, and he had businesses, or he still does now in Canada, or lawyers. You know, it's very international people, and he wanted to basically be allowed to travel and be able to use his money and do business. And the way he figured he would do it is really try to secure the release of two French journalists who were kidnapped for longer than me, more or less at the same time, were released after, and in a different area. And but he was spitting in the wrong hole, so he ended up looking in my area, and he got in touch with that rebel group who had me, and they said, we don't have these two guys, but we have this guy. So it was complete luck. But there were other, Al-Nusra wanted to buy me, apparently. I found that after the fact, because that rebel group was going to sell me from biggest bidder, right?
Whoever could bidder, yeah, highest bidder.
Highest bidder, sorry. And so I was very lucky because he ended up wanting to pay a certain amount of money. They started negotiating. To make a long story short, they agreed on the amount of $500,000, and they got me out. And he hid me for a while, and then he smuggled me back into Lebanon. He was taken out of that list, and then he was put back on it.
And you went back to the U.S. and you saw your family and friends, and then, in a quintessential part of the story of the war photographer, you get right back into it. And you've been since then, you went to Ukraine and Egypt and elsewhere, correct?
Yes. It was a bit of my salvation after meeting Bonnie Timmerman in a New York restaurant a couple of weeks, maybe 2 or 3 weeks after I came back. So this was August 2013.
Okay.
And, I wanted to get back in the game. It was just my personality. And I did go to Egypt during all the bombings. So I went back into it. The danger levels are not nearly as bad. So it's not like a war, but it's, it was a nice reintroduction into the mix. And then the war in the Ukraine started. So I immersed myself in that conflict quite a bit. And I covered that. It was in 2 years, I did 7 trips. Spent quite a bit of time, and so for a long, I would go for many weeks every time, and then I stopped for a bit. I did other things, and then I decided to cover Mosul in Iraq, which I did extensively, and then I was in Venezuela also for some time shooting for a client.
And then, did being captive in Syria influence how you covered, or how you even saw some of these other conflicts, or did you get right back to where you had been before?
No, in terms of like as a professional, you never come back unscathed from any trip, and let alone being kidnapped. So you do change. However, purely as a professional, I was the same, except that you're more paranoid at checkpoints, because that's why I was kidnapped at a checkpoint. So that kicks back in. It's like having someone who's been doing acid for years and stopped for many years, and sometimes he has these returns. It's flashbacks, sorry. Same thing. Because it's same thing, because it's a permanent imprint in the way your brain is rewired, who has been rewired due to these events, and it kicks back in. It's like almost like a shock. And you're at this checkpoint and you have an issue, and I've had many since. Mm-hmm. Checkpoint's always a problem. And you think about, oh, what if I get kidnapped? It's always in your mind. So you become a little paranoiac. And that's something I'm going to have to, however long I do this profession, I will always have this issue.
What did you see, like I asked you on Syria, what were your impressions of Ukraine and the conflict there?
Ukraine was a tough war, not in terms of casualties so much, but there were pretty heavy battles. It was very World War II, like, it was very interesting, actually. And I'm a quarter Russian, so I have affinity with these people, and I understand their history, and I know them well. So I know how to cope with them very well. And I covered both sides extensively. And the information war that was involved in that conflict in some ways supersedes the actual combat on the ground. Everybody on both sides, or the governments, or hackers, anyone was using all the social media to spread lies, equally on both sides, in an intense fashion, to a point where it became very difficult to decipher the truth from not the truth, even if you were there, unless you were physically in where the event was happening, which was not always the case. And in the more geopolitical sense, I think Ukraine made a mistake. I think Ukraine had a good position geographically to be doing business with both the West and Russia. Knowing very well that Russia would never let Ukraine go. That will never happen for the reasons I explained earlier on, as it's Russians are still traumatized by the 25 million dead they've had in 4 years in World War II, which they call the Great Patriotic War of 1941 to 1945. And people don't forget that. Russians are an old people and a very old traumatic history, more than pretty much most countries in the world, in my opinion, and the 20th century is a great proof of it. And there are other examples. So for them, it was just a no-brainer. There's no way they won't let that go. And Putin was very smart in waging a conflict that was not really a conflict without using conventional troops, but using Russian mercenaries a lot, Russian equipment, but always a war that was still contained. There were some pretty significant battles, but it wasn't like an all-out war when Russian army would come in and take half of Ukraine. It was like, well, now we have you back. But so it was a much more modern way and smart way to wage a conflict.
Are you concerned with regards to the information wars that you saw there and that you see here elsewhere about how it'll affect photography? I mean, many journalists are obviously worried about print and social media stories. Do you worry about how it'll affect the legitimacy of the photographs you take in terms of how the public sees them?
Very good question. And it has I would have two answers. The first one is there's a significant trend and that's been proven over and over through many studies that people don't trust journalists anymore.
Right.
Less and less. There's really a decline, which partially explains why people don't buy print. It's not the only reason. We have new technology. Young generations you read the press the same way. There's a mentality issue. So it's just a partial explanation. But it's a significant one because the media has lost a lot of its neutrality. In my opinion, everybody is entitled to his opinion, and you should always respect it and have a good intellectual conversation with someone who disagrees with you. It's the best way to potentially agree, at least to some degree. It happens, and it's happened to me and to other people, obviously. So the media, I think, has made a mistake in losing its neutrality, and people are really, and Trump obviously has played this card brilliantly. And by feeding off the fact that many people didn't like CNN and the media. So it backfired for the media, and the sales are going down. On the technological side, guys like us have become too expensive. We'll become obsolete in some ways. Like guys like us who reach the top of our career, we ask for a lot of money because it's super risky and you have to pay for a fixer. It's hundreds of bucks a day, a hotel. It adds up really quickly and the press doesn't have the money anymore. So what do? They will hire local guys who are very mixed bag. Most of them are average, but it's also difficult to control what they're really doing. And therefore the media is in complete change state of affair. And in my opinion, my profession is really dying out, and the best criteria to know this is that it's harder and harder to make money.
So it's similar pressures. It's interesting that the rest of the media faces, which also erode the quality of a lot of what we are able to get, are affecting photography. But since you are one of the very excellent photographers, what's striking about our conversation is your sense of history and politics and your understanding of the different arenas where you are. How this is coming from someone who is not a photographer, how do you select what you're going to shoot and how you're going to shoot it? I think for many people, the image of the war photographer, you're just in the zone, you're taking the pictures as the bullets fly, but you're very thoughtful. Is that image correct? How do you structure where you're going to be?
Interesting. You have to do things that pay unless you have a huge amount of money backing you, which is not the case for most of us. But you want to do projects that you love, but to do them, you need money. And how to get money, you have to do projects that you don't want to do so much. That's true for every profession. There's no exception for us. Covering the Ukraine was a very profitable enterprise. Because, obviously I had very big clients. I was shooting for Vanity Fair, shooting for CNN, and a couple of agencies, so I did very well. And the country was cheap hotels, cheap everything, so it was easier. I used to cover lots of conflicts in Africa. Africa is, no one cares. You do it because you want to go, and it's very expensive. So the money you get back from it is usually you lose money, or you might break even at best. So it's not worth it. And they're very. I've covered wars in, you know, Somalia, Ogaden, in these areas quite a bit earlier in my career. And I said I was shooting for the BBC, so I had pretty big backings. But it was at best I would make some money, but not near enough to have enough money to maybe do something else that I wanted to do down the line.
At even at a more basic level, when you're in Syria, when you're in Ukraine, when you're anywhere, how does a photographer such as yourself know where to go or decide physically where to be? I mean, is there a particular story you are hired to cover? Or once you're there, how do you know what's going to be the most riveting image? It's like documentary makers always tell you, they just take endless amounts of footage and they never know what the story is actually going to be. How do you do it in a high-risk area?
Well, it's transcendent. So the first segment would be you want to try to anticipate what could happen politically in different countries and jump on it. And if you have a little bit of luck, you're one of the first ones to be there. I didn't think there was going to be a war in the Ukraine, so I wasn't the quickest off the mark. But then I stayed in, and it worked out. But for Syria, we were. So it depends. You make mistakes. One on the ground depends. Some photographers are crazier than others, and I'm pretty average when it comes to it. But I know guys who want to go where it's the worst. However, the heaviest bombing or firefights, that's where they want to be. I've done this. It wasn't always my choice, but I'm a little bit more careful usually. I try to step back a bit and try to understand, then I jump in. It explains partially what I've survived all these wars. A lot of guys get killed every year. And so you have to try to understand how locals function culturally and how they operate, how they deal with each other, to try to get a sense of how things might become a fight or not. So you really have to spend a lot of time and listen. Actually, most of the time we spend is waiting. I would say the actual photography aspect, like I said, the combat, is like probably 10%, not that much. The rest is organizing, traveling, waiting, and waiting.
And do you ever think, when I have taught photography in a bigger class, one of the things the students often like to discuss is thinking about how the photographer constructed the photograph, kind of how they thought about what they were taking, or they, when you teach about Jacob Riis and the progressive era photography in the United States, there's a lot of writing about how he would organize his subjects to capture the image he wanted. Do you ever think, as you're taking the photographs, about the implications of an image, or are you in the moment and just capturing what you see?
No, to be honest with you, maybe some guys will disagree with me, but for me, it's always the moment. You think as a professional and also as an artist, so you also think about how you're going to compose your picture. And you want to make a great photograph. You feel very career oriented. You want to have a good name. So there's also a selfish personal aspect to what you're doing, but that's the honest way to look at it. So do I think the impact? No, I don't think about that while I'm on the ground. You think about that afterwards when you're home, if you do interviews and things become a little bit public, then you can, it's good. You come back and you go back to your trip and you think about it. And then you can have a more proper and poised answers to these kinds of questions. When you're in the battle and, you know, bullets are flying and bombs are dropping, you're behind the camera and you're hiding because you're scared. But if you're not, you're really thinking about how am I going to make a good picture and tell a good story.
And we're almost out of time. But with this book, what do you hope to share with the public? Is it the story itself, or is there something additional that you hope the book conveys?
I think it's interesting for people to know what it is to be a combat photographer, like what it entails and what we go through, because we're more of a discreet type, and it might sound ironic because I'm doing public things right now to talk about the book, but as a whole, most of the, you know, there are a lot of big egos, let me tell you, but there are also a lot of loners, lone wolves. Guys are a little off their minds, you know, they're not fully, they don't feel at home when they're at home, you know, they feel at home when they're in war. So, yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Once again, I want to thank Jonathan Alperi, who has written a really just amazing book. I think everyone should read this, A Shattered Lens, A War Photographer's True Story of Captivity and Survival in Syria. It's with Simon & Schuster. It's out in bookstores, Amazon, all other booksellers that you can access. They have this, and I really I urge people to read this. It's fascinating, and thank you for joining our show.
Thank you.
Well, that wraps up our episode, and thanks for joining us, and we'll be back soon on Politics and Polls.
You've been listening to Politics and Polls, a podcast series produced by WooCast. This podcast is intended to be informational only and does not reflect nor represent the views of Princeton University or the Woodrow Wilson School of Public and International Affairs.